The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of Salem Media of Hawaii.
Aloha, I'm Braden DeVos and I'm back. Please support the homeless children. They're in danger. If you have any extra clothes or food, please give it to them. Now you're on with Jeff, the solar guy.
Aloha, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, on this Tuesday, November 18th. And today we are going deep, real deep, to the deepest trench in the ocean, the Mariana Trench. We are lucky to be joined live by the science team and crew aboard Schmidt Ocean Institute's research vessel Falkor, currently working on a long expedition for about 4 weeks in the Serena Deep. We will be talking with three scientists who have seen it all, from new species of fish to using brand new equipment in one of the greatest pressure areas in the world. So without further ado, let's share a little bit about this exciting research and the unique place to be. Calling us live from the Mariana Trench, first is Dr. Jeff Drazen. Jeff, are you with us?
Hi, Carly.
Oh, excellent. You sound like you're just right next door. Welcome to the show. So, Jeff, you are a marine ecologist in the Oceanography Department at the University of Hawaii, and you study the role of fish in deep sea habitats. So what first got you interested in these deep sea food webs?
Well, I've always been interested in the way that animals interact with each other. And a lot of those interactions are through being predators or prey for other things. And food webs are a fun way to study an ecosystem because you're basically looking at a map of how that ecosystem functions or the animals in that ecosystem interact with each other. And you can think of things like phytoplankton at the bottom of the food web and things like sharks at the top. And in between are all the various animals in the system, and they're all connected to one another. They may not be directly connected, but through a couple of steps, most organisms are related to all other organisms in the system.
And are there specific organisms that you're interested in within the food web?
Well, my research focuses more on the top of food webs, and particularly fishes in the marine ecosystem, but some other top predators as well.
And what really distinguishes some of the fish that you've been seeing in these deep trench areas versus some of the, I guess, shallower species that you work on?
Well, the deep sea is full of marvelous and bizarre creatures. We find lots of new things down there, and they are just so very different than a lot of the animals that we're more used to when we go snorkeling on a coral reef or go to the seashore and explore under stones in a tide pool. One of the fascinating fishes that we found out here is one of the very deepest living fishes in the world, and it's called a snail fish, and that's the group of fishes. And this animal kind of looks like a tadpole. It's about 10 inches long at the most, and it has very small eyes. There's not a lot of light down there. And its body is almost transparent. So when we catch them, you can actually see right through into their intestines and their liver, and it's bizarre. But they've got a cute little face with a blunt little nose and hardly any teeth at all. And they're just fascinating because they are the ones, for whatever reason, this is part of what we're trying to understand, they are the ones that seem to have evolved to live in these trenches. They're really endemic to just a trench environment.
And I've been fortunate enough to see some of the images that you guys have been sending back on the SchmidtOcean.org blog, and they really are very interesting-looking animals. Now, have you seen other unique species so far? Anything new on this expedition versus past expeditions that you've been on?
Yeah, we've seen a couple of species of fish called rat tails, and these have long, tapering, eel-like tails, but the front of their body looks like most other fish you might see. And We think we've seen a couple. Well, we haven't ever seen them before. We haven't been able to catch them. We just have photographs of them, so we don't know if they truly are new or not, but they look very unusual to us. And I think I want to add, too, that with the snailfish, we have found these snailfish, different species, in other trenches. And so it's really kind of curious. These animals seem to have become the top predator down in the trenches repeatedly at different places around the globe.
And when you talk about these deep trenches, you say you've seen them in other trenches. Now, we're not talking that they're next-door neighbors. These are trenches that are separated, I'm assuming, by great distance. What makes these deep trenches or hadal zones? We also hear that term a lot. Can you explain a little bit what these deep trenches are?
Yeah, so the hadal zone are the depths below the majority of the flat plains of the ocean. And so that's deeper than about 6,000 meters or so. And if you want to put that into feet, that means these are habitats that are deeper than about 21,000 feet or 4 miles down. So these are the really deepest parts of the ocean. A trench is probably the most common type of feature in the hadal zone, and this is where an oceanic plate is being subducted or pulled underneath another plate, and that process creates a trench, if you will, this deep place where the plate is being pulled under. And the greatest depth is roughly 11,000 meters or 7 miles deep.
Wow, those are much deeper areas than a lot of the other parts of the ocean. Now, I imagine working in these environments creates a lot of challenges, even just being able to access these environments. Now, I know you've had a lot of work with different types of instruments like landers or underwater robots. How do you use these instruments to access these deep areas?
Yeah, the deep sea is a very challenging place to work. You've got tens of thousands of feet of water, so it's incredibly high pressure and cold temperatures, and of course it's dark. And it's submarines and remotely operated vehicles are great tools for getting into deep sea environments. There are very few submarines that have been made to dive to trench depths. It's very risky, of course, putting people in there. Just recently, James Cameron built a submarine, and he went to the bottom of the Marianas Trench. That sub isn't working at the moment. Right now, our greatest sub capability is the Chinese submersible Xialong, and it goes to 7,000 meters. So it's just, using submarines is great. Using ROVs is great because it's like you're there. You can react to things by looking at the video on the cameras, and you have robotic arms, and you can take very precise samples and conduct experiments. But there's a lot of danger in using subs, and with the ROVs, you have a tether that connects this robotic vehicle to the surface where you're controlling it. And the Japanese had a wonderful ROV called the Kaiko. It's now lost, but the tether was this connection to the ship fit on an enormous spool, and they basically had a dedicated ship for this vehicle, and apparently the Kaiko was difficult to use and maneuver underwater because of it. The United States, we had an ROV called the Nereus, and it used a very tiny fiber optic tether. This thing didn't carry power. You can think of it as fishing line. It was just a fiber optic, and it literally, it was like 20-pound test fishing line. If you're a fisherman, you can envision that pretty easily. Unfortunately, due to the very difficult nature of the environment, this vehicle was lost earlier in the year at 10,000 meters in the Kermadec Trench. So those instruments do work well. We also have available to us landers. These are platforms that are relatively low cost, and they're relatively low risk to the submarines and remotely operated vehicles. And that's what we're using on this cruise. So the lander is simply a platform, and you put your sampling device on it, and you drop it off the back of a ship, and it sinks to the seafloor all by itself to conduct an experiment or collect samples. And then on this lander, there's what we call an acoustic release. It's an instrument. It holds onto an anchor, and it listens for a sound signal from the ship. And when we send that sound signal, it drops the anchor, and there's floats on it, on the lander itself, and it carries it back up to the surface where we can pick it up with the ship.
Where I'm sure you're waiting with bated breath on the deck, making sure it comes up.
It's quite nerve-jarring at times when you can't talk to the release on the lander. But it's so very exciting when something comes back and you get to take a look at the samples that you've collected from these very deep parts of the ocean.
So now on this expedition that you've been on, you have had a few successful deployments of the landers. What type of instruments have you been using on the landers, and what are you bringing back up with you?
So we have a baited trap. It's very simply like a lobster pot, and this allows us to catch fishes like the snail fish that I was talking about, shrimps, and these large shrimp-like animals called amphipods. And if you've ever been to the beach and you've tossed over seaweed that's piled up, there'll be these little beach hoppers that jump away. And they're very small, certainly smaller than the end of your pinky finger. And in the deep ocean, in the trenches, these things can reach enormous proportions, and they can be as much as 8 inches long. And so the baited traps allow us to collect these animals and study their biology. We have also a baited camera, and so for animals that aren't quite so easy to trap, and so that we can observe their behaviors in their environment, we can film them and take photographs of them with these camera systems. And then we have a coring device on one lander, and that takes sediment cores. And from those sediment cores, we can sieve out all the little worms and other animals that live there and look at that community of organisms that just lives in the mud. And then finally, we have another lander that has a series of metal grabs on it, and that allows us to, again, collect the mud, but also hopefully rocks and pebbles and stones for geological investigations and understanding the dynamics in that arena. And that's something that Patty Fryer can talk more about.
And we'll be talking to her soon. So it really is, you know, a nerve-wracking experience, I guess, and also such an exciting experience to wait and see what you're going to discover once those landers come up.
Yeah, it definitely takes some getting used to put your time and effort into building something and then take it and throw it off the back of a ship. And then you wait hours and hours, and you pray that this thing will actually come back to the surface. But it does, and when we get those samples back, it's just so very exciting. An hour ago, we brought up one of the traps, and it had four of the snail fish in it, and also a small shrimp we hadn't seen before. And it's fantastic.
Wow, well, I'm excited to see some of the images from that. Now, these deep areas that you're accessing and the Mariana Trench, they can be protected, part of marine protected areas. How is the research that you're doing informing some of the management concerns or management structure regarding these deep environments?
Yeah, the trench is part of the Mariana Trench Marine National Monument, and this zone protects the trench, deep seamounts, mud volcanoes, islands in the Northern Mariana Arc. But the least understood and investigated of the habitats that are in this monument is the trench itself. And, of course, that's its namesake. Managers don't have a great idea yet of what lives there and where those animals are living. And if to sort of help their management efforts, we'll be gathering information on who and where. And that's going to be useful for them to know what's being protected, and then down the road, how that relates to communities and trenches elsewhere that aren't protected. How unique is the Mariana Trench? And that's something that we hope to address.
Well, I hope that you have great success in addressing this, and I'm very excited to see all the different species that you'll be able to look at using these landers and some of the observations that you make. Jeff, I want to thank you so much for taking some time to chat with us today. It's amazing that we're talking to you from the middle of the ocean on top of the Mariana Trench, and I know how busy you are on board with all the different things you're doing. So thank you very much. We are going to take a quick traffic break, but stay with us because when we return, we're going to continue talking about the Mariana Trench with Dr. Patty Fryer.
KGU, part of the Wall Street Business Network.
More problems if you're going east on the freeway. Got an accident reported at the Cocoa Head Avenue exit ramp from the H1. Also had one on the H1 westbound at the Y-Model Pearl City exit. If you're going that way, you can expect slow traffic on the H1 by the airport exit. The Moanalua slow before Middle Street. Kamehameha Highway westbound is normal from the airport to Pearl City. It's also a typical drive over to the windward side.
Aloha, this is your solar guide, Jeff Davis. Our company, Kamiyama Solar, has been licensed for over 25 years here locally. We are a solar company with local roots. It's that time of year with solar photovoltaic, solar water, even solar-powered air conditioning or pool pumps. This is the time of year that folks can install solar, save money, and receive your 65% tax credit, state and federal, quickly upon filing your taxes. Hawaiian Electric has stated that a grandfather clause will exist for those that install PV before their new rules kick in. Call me now, Jeff Davis, the solar guy, at 554-7200, 554-7200, and at least secure your place in HECO's line. There's no fee, there's no binding contract. Just get in line and let's install your solar, electric, or water heating system before the year runs out. Call me, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, at 554-7200, or surf to kamiyamasolar.com. That's 554-7200. Free estimates available on request. Aloha from the solar guy, Jeff Davis, and Kamiyama Solar.
280,000 acres. That's the size of Molokai, Lanai, and Kahoolawe put together. It's also the amount of the prime farmable ag land designated in Hawaii. 280,000 acres. That's a lot of prime farmable ag land, and it needs to be preserved for agriculture. Aloha, I'm Dean Okimoto of Nalo Farms, and this fact is brought to you by Ho'opili, a new community where commercial farms, neighborhood, and home gardens will be part of the community's design. And there's so much more. Log on to www.ho'opili'oahu.com.
My name is Braden Navas, and I believe in education. I say get one. Take it, solar guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal, and today we are talking live with the research team currently out in the Mariana Trench exploring our deep ocean environment aboard research vessel Falkor. With us now is another principal investigator, Dr. Patricia Fryer. Dr. Fryer is a marine geologist in the Geology and Geophysics Department at the University of Hawaii. No stranger to the Mariana Trench, Patty has participated in 47 marine expeditions, including a 2012 trip with James Cameron. Patty, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Carly.
Hi, welcome to the show. I'm so glad you could make some time to chat with us today.
Oh, thank you very much. That's a delight.
So we just spoke with Dr. Jeff Drazen, and he's focused really on the biology of the trench, but your work's taking a bit of a different approach. Tell me a little bit about the trench geology and what you're looking at on this expedition.
All right. The Mariana Trench is particularly interesting because of the fact that it's so deep. It actually exposes the upper part of the Earth's mantle down in the greatest depths, at depths greater than about 7,000 meters. So we will be able to observe and hopefully to be able to get samples from down there. And that's deeper than anybody is able to dive with a submersible or a remotely operated vehicle that currently exists and is available to us.
Now, Jeff described how he gets his observations or samples by using some of the baited fish traps. How do you go about getting your samples?
Normally, what I'll do to get samples down there is either use a remotely operated vehicle or dredge things. We can just put a metal frame with a chain bag attached to it over the side of a ship, lower it down to the seafloor, and then just drag it upslope. The problem with that, of course, is you don't really know exactly where you get samples from. And the longer you leave it down, you know, the greater the territory you cover on the seafloor, the less likely you are to know exactly where things come from. So on our trip, what we're hoping to be able to do is deploy one of the landers that Jeff described earlier that has a couple of grab samplers. These are kind of like clamshells that close when they hit the seafloor and will clamp onto rocks or potentially scoop up sediment and bring that material back up to the surface when the lander returns. So by doing that, we're hoping that we'll be able to get some samples from deeper down in this trench than anybody has been able to collect before.
Well, I hope that you do get some samples. That would be really interesting to take a look at. Now,
you bet.
You said when we had talked previously, this is your 47th marine research expedition. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
So that you've been spending
a lot of time at sea.
Yeah, you've been to sea quite a few times. Now, how does this expedition differ? Do they all start to blend together for you?
Well, on each one. Every time you go out, you find something new. This one is totally different. I'm learning new things every day. It's fascinating. I'm learning more about how fish are attracted to different parts of the ocean, you know. Mm-hmm. And when I've been out on expeditions here in the Mariana region previously, we have found seeps on the seafloor where fluids actually that are being driven off the plate that is subducting or the tectonic plate that's going down beneath the Mariana region. And these fluids that are rising at seeps on the seafloor are bringing up chemicals from reactions of those fluids with upper mantle rocks of the earth and creating environments where certain types of subsurface microbial communities flourish. And as a consequence, there are other organisms that we find at these seeps as well, things like mussels and clams, crabs and tube worms and snails that are feeding on essentially on one another down there. So it's really clear that biology and geology are intimately interlinked in these kinds of environments.
It's such a neat way to think about the deep ocean, and we know so little about it. It must be so exciting to be on the forefront of this research.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's nothing in the world like being able to either go down to the seafloor or see something from a remotely operated vehicle. Every single time you put one of those instruments in the oceans, you know you're going to be putting your eyes on something that nobody else in the world has ever seen before. And constantly there are surprises. There's so little that we know about these extreme environments, either because they're too deep or because the chemistry of the environment may be unique and organisms that had never been discovered previously are living there. For instance, on the Cameron cruise that I went on in 2012, my biological colleague, Doug Bartlett from Scripps Institution of Oceanography, brought back some of these crustaceans, these amphipods that Jeff mentioned a little earlier, and did some chemistry on molecules in their guts and found that these are identical to the kinds of things that are used to treat Alzheimer's in patients that are suffering from that disease. There are all kinds of applications, potentially, from a lot of the things that we learn in the deep sea that we would never have expected before.
It just blows my mind that, you know, you can find all these amazing discoveries, you know, from one particular species or one particular animal, not just the animals, but the geology itself. Now, I know you've talked about some of the work you've done studying serpentine mud volcanoes that you find in the Mariana
right.
Trench. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is something that is unique to the Mariana system. It is undergoing a whole lot of extension. That means that the seafloor is being sort of torn apart by tectonic forces. And as a result, there are faults in the subsurface below the seafloor that let fluids and ground up rocks from movement along these faults rise as sort of a mush up to the surface of the seafloor and sort of protrude out and build up over time immense big mounds of mud. In fact, the largest of these is bigger than the island of Oahu. So it's not the sort of thing that people normally think of when they hear the word volcano. They think of lava and hot things coming out. But these muds are generally very cool. The highest temperature was about, 30 degrees C or so, you know, a warm day in Honolulu. But these are essentially cold seeps when it's not actively erupting mud from deep.
Interesting. And these volcanoes, how...
Communities.
Or communities, how deep are they?
Yes, Carly, you're breaking up.
I'm sorry. Are these volcanoes, how deep? Where would you find them? How deep are they in terms of depth?
Oh, they vary tremendously. The deepest one that we know of is sitting down at, about the base of it's about 8,000 meters, but it rises to 6,000. So they tend to be about 2,000 meters high. That's a little over a mile. And up to 50 kilometers or 30 miles in diameter. So, yeah, these are immense, and they have been erupting for 50 million years. This is an astounding convergent margin where two plates are crashing into one another in the Western Pacific.
And there are a lot of other famous sites in the Mariana Trench as well. When we hear a lot about the research cruises, we often hear about Challenger Deep or Serena Deep. Can you tell us a little bit about these sites and how they differ?
Yeah, the Challenger Deep and Serena Deep both are extremely deep portions of the trench, but the trench depth varies along its length as a consequence of the subduction of features on the Pacific plate that is going down beneath the Mariana plate. So, for instance, if you have a big seamount that's approaching the trench and over time it begins to be subducted, it lifts up the center of the trench as the big seamount goes down on the plate it's sitting on. For the Serena Deep, what's happening is that there is a very prominent north-south oriented fault that the west side of which is moving southward next to Guam. It's right next to Guam. It separates some shallow banks that the fishermen like to go out and fish on from the island itself. And there are lots of earthquakes along this fault where it reaches the Mariana Trench is right at the Serena Deep. So the fact that there is a zone of weakness in the overriding plate where it contacts the Mariana Trench, then you get a particularly deep area because there's tectonic movement going on. And we think a very similar sort of thing is happening west over west where the Challenger Deep is, and that is that the overriding plate is kind of breaking apart, being stretched from east to west, and there's a lot of material that is being broken off, carried down southward toward the trench, and then eventually being subducted. So it's kind of like, you know, this bulldozer effect that you're digging out a big hole as a consequence of the tectonic activity, the earthquake activity, and dumping that into the trench, and then it gets taken down. So it's similar but slightly different types of tectonic seismic action that's going on in these two different places. But basically, that's what's doing it.
I'm so happy I asked you that. I would have never known that otherwise. Now, where are you guys right now? Where is the Falkor ship, and are you planning to hit any of these areas on the expedition that you're going on?
Yeah, right now we're working in an area that's about 7,000 and 8,000 meters deep. And it's just south of Guam. It's north of the trench. And what we're planning to do is eventually continue to move southward down this fault-controlled canyon that's just to the west of Guam to get to the Serena Deep. And eventually we will have a complete line of sample positions that go down to the trench and then go up onto the Pacific plate that's being subducted. What we're planning to do is, after we're finished with the current location that we're working at, we're going to move over to the downgoing plate and start taking samples from there, and that's mainly to compare the ecology of the environments in which the various fish and amphipods may be located on the downgoing plate to compare them to the overriding plate. And this is a big question for Jeff and the other biologists on the cruise as to, you know, just how deep do fish go? And you'll be hearing from Paul Yancey, who, I must correct myself, Doug Bartlett told me about the finding of the Alzheimer's molecules in these amphipods, but actually it was Paul who discovered it. It's just that Doug told me about the fact that it was discovered. But, you know, you get a chance to ask him in detail all about those wonderful things. He's working on the molecular aspects of the tissues in the fish themselves, and what he's been telling me is absolutely fascinating. I had no idea that there were limits, perhaps, to the depth that fish can attain as a consequence of just the molecular structure in their cell. So I'm learning a whole lot more than I had ever expected about biology when I'm on this cruise, and it's been a lot of fun.
Well, I have too, just from listening to you all today and following along with the blogs. Now, will this be your only research expedition to the Mariana Trench, or does your work take you elsewhere in the world?
Oh, no, I've been lots of places. I've done a bunch of cruises all around the Western Pacific, but also on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and that was a drilling cruise with the International Ocean Drilling Program, and we were actually looking at the same sorts of reactions between seawater and mantle rocks over on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and surprisingly, people have found very similar kinds of structures that we see on the Mariana Forearc to those that exist on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. People may have heard of the Lost City, which is an area where huge chimneys made out of calcium carbonate or calcite, and this is the same mineral structure as forms coral reefs, but completely different, not coralline, but rather just a chemosynthetic formation of chemical reactions that take place between seawater that's interacting with mantle rocks and the rocks themselves produces these enormous structures that can be, you know, 30 meters high. That's almost 100 feet. And the same sorts of things were first discovered here in the Mariana region on top of these mud volcanoes. And the big difference is that in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, the water that is reacting to create these structures is the seawater that's entering faults along the mid-ocean ridge, whereas here, the fluids that are essentially being distilled out of the subducting Pacific plate. So the chemistry of the fluids is different, and therefore the biology, the microbiology of the animals associated with the chimney structures in the two different environments are different. So we're going to be able to take a look at the chemistry of these chimney samples and perhaps be able to define, you know, which ones form where and how they do it.
Well, Patty, you just make marine geology come alive. It's such an interesting topic. Now, I would love to talk to you more, but I'm also very excited to hear about Dr. Yancey and some of the work that he's doing with these fish. So we're going to take a quick traffic break, but hang tight. When we get back, we will continue talking about surprising species of the deep.
760 KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
No problems to the windward side, although there is an accident reported on the H3 Honolulu bound up by Hospital Rock. The drive east is normal to Hawaii Kai. To the west, the H1 slows on the viaduct, the Moanalua before middle. Inbound traffic slow from Ola Lane to Punahou. A reminder that the H1 westbound is going to be completely closed overnight from Huff-Tailing to Middle Street from 8 o'clock this evening till 5 in the morning.
Hi, I'm Frank Rogers from Leakmaster Roofing and the Cool Roof Store. We sell and install protective roof coatings for all types of roofs. What kind of roof do you have? For flat roofs, we recommend silicone roof coatings because they withstand unlimited ponding water and they come with a 50-year material warranty. We feature trusted names like Geico, NXT Cool Zone, and Apoc Silicone with some of the lowest prices in town. If you have a Monier roof or a metal roof, we recommend that you recoat them with NXT Cool Zone to make them shine like new. Asphalt shingles can be protected and waterproof for the lifetime of your home with the Cool Roof Store's ceramic coating. Whether you want Leakmaster Roofing to install the coating or want to do it yourself, come on down to our store in Kaka'ako or visit us at leakmaster.com. Why re-roof when you can simply recoat?
Aloha! Hawaii's Tomorrow and Jeff Davis are looking for motivated people. Are you a writer? The Solar Guy could use some comedy. Would you like to intern? You know he's got room, so give Jeff a call. Jeff Davis at 554-7200. 554-7200.
Aloha. This is a solar daughter, Lena Davis. My dad, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, has been telling me to listen to him my whole life. It's helped me, and I'm sure it'll help you too. Be sure to listen to My Dad, the Solar Guy, 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on 760 KGU. Aloha.
My name is Britton DeVos, and I believe in education. I say get one. Take it, Solar Guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal, and today we are virtually aboard Schmidt Ocean Institute's research vessel Falkor above the deepest part of the ocean, the Mariana Trench. Joining us now is Dr. Paul Yancey, Professor and Chair of Sciences at Whitman College in Washington State. He's also serving as a lead on this expedition, in addition to Dr. Jeff Drazen and Patty Fryer. Dr. Yancey is also the Director of Deep Sea for marinebio.org. Dr. Yancey, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Happy to be here.
Excellent. Welcome to the show.
Yeah,
now,
glad to be here.
Unlike Dr. Drazen and Dr. Fryer, you're taking a different approach to some of your research aboard the Falkor. You're looking at the biochemical and physiological adaptations of these marine animals. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing aboard the ship?
Well, deep sea animals have to deal with very extreme conditions that we don't find in surface waters. Lack of sunlight, cold in most places, also very low food supply in most places, and, of course, very high pressure. And on this particular expedition, I'm focusing on pressure, which creates a huge weight on top of these organisms, and we're trying to understand what organisms can tolerate high pressures and how can they do it.
And what is sort of the process that you take? So when you get up in the morning, walk me through a typical day that you would do on the cruise to study these animals.
Well, on the ship, there's only so much we can do. What happens is we get ready for the animal traps to come back up that Jeff described. And when they get in, we have to preserve the tissues as quickly as we can before they break down. So we have a team of all of the biologists together, get the animals out, dissect them as necessary, and usually freeze the tissues in liquid nitrogen to keep them intact and, you know, before the tropical heat can degrade them. And so there's not a lot we can do on the ship in terms of the actual biochemical analyses. We'll have to do that in the laboratory back home.
And
but there's a lot of processing to do.
And some of the precautions that you take when you bring these species up, I mean, because they're entering different environments coming from such great depth and pressure, how quickly do they degrade? Are they harder to work with than, let's say, if you just caught a fish at 30 meters depth?
Absolutely, yes. They are much more delicate. So we just have to be as fast as we can. In some cases, we have a container that can help keep some of the smaller animals insulated from the heat of the tropics. For the big fish, though, we don't have any way to do that. So basically, we just get them in as quickly as we can and cool the tissues down to prevent degradation. That's an ongoing problem. Someday, we'll probably build pressure chambers that can close a lid down deep and hold the animals at their normal temperature and pressure. But right now, we don't have that ability.
Well, there's a project for some aspiring engineers. And when you bring the samples back to your lab, let's say, once you get back to shore, the expedition is done, and you have these preserved samples, you mentioned some molecular analysis. What does that entail, and what is that going to tell you? What are you looking for in these samples?
Well, we're looking at two different things. One of them is we look at the complex biomolecules like proteins and DNA to see if they're different, to see if they work differently under pressure than the same ones from shallow animals or the comparable ones. So that's one thing we do. And those, we do have small pressure chambers in the laboratory where we can put tissue extracts, proteins from and DNA from the animals. But the other thing we're looking for are small organic molecules that we've discovered can protect the larger molecules like proteins and DNA from pressure. So that's a different kind of adaptation. And that's turning out to be really exciting. There's all kinds of interesting small molecules that seem to provide a protection from the crushing weight of the pressure. And those are the ones Patty mentioned that might actually have medical applications.
So what do you do when you find something that has these medical applications, like the amphipods that could potentially assist with Alzheimer's that Patty mentioned?
Yeah, that was actually an interesting coincidence. We discovered that it's a small sugar called siloinositol that you normally don't find in animals, but we found a lot of it in the amphipods that Doug Bartlett collected, and we're going to look at the current amphipods we're catching as well. And it had already been chosen by medical researchers to treat Alzheimer's disease. And so we're looking at whether that's a coincidence or not, and we think it's not a coincidence. Alzheimer's disease is caused by a protein that folds up improperly inside brain cells, and pressure causes proteins to fold up improperly as well. And so it looks like siloinositol can help proteins work under pressure, but can also help sort of make the protein of Alzheimer's disease fold up properly and not cause the disease. So there probably is some close relationship. And these protective molecules we're looking at.
Oh, we lost you there. Are you still there?
Diseases. Oh, pardon?
Sorry, you cut out there for a second. We lost
Hello?
You. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's cutting out.
Well, let's take a step back.
Anyway, there's lots of this. Uh-oh.
That's okay. Let's take a step back
Hello?
From the Alzheimer's and the amphipods and talk a little bit about how often are you discovering new species when you're out in the trench? Do you anticipate every time that you go down with a lander that you're going to find a new species or something new about a species?
Well, there's always the potential to find a new species every time. I think Jeff mentioned that. But it doesn't happen every time, but certainly every deep sea expedition I've been on, we've always found two or three new species at a minimum, and sometimes more. So yeah, the potential's always there. That's one of the exciting things about the lander coming back up. Never know what you're going to see, or the lander with the video pictures as well.
And Jeff also talked earlier.
Fairly often.
Oh, and Jeff talked earlier about these larger amphipods. Do you see this gigantism or bigger species in just the amphipods, or does that happen with a lot of the species in deeper depths?
It does happen with other kinds of organisms. I think most people know about the giant squid, for example. That's a deep sea squid, much bigger than shallow squids. There are other animals like isopods, little garden roly-poly type pill bugs that people know about. Those get to be as bigger than these giant amphipods in the deep sea. So yeah, there are other groups that get really large, and we don't really know why, because not all groups get large. So it's a bit of a mystery.
Well, I love all these mysteries that you guys are working to solve. And when you find something new, whether it's a new molecular find or a new species, what's the process that you go through to share that information, or what are the next steps that you do once you find out this information?
For a new species, we have to find a world expert on that particular animal group and send it to them to analyze. Sometimes it means looking at the detailed structure of the animal. Sometimes it means doing DNA analysis. But quite often there's only perhaps one expert in the world on a particular group of animals, so we have to find that person and send it to them. If it's a new biomolecule that we think might have medical application, that's, we actually work with the National Institutes of Health and a couple of biotechnology companies that I'm working with to test that and see if it has medical application.
And in a recent blog that you put on Schmidt Ocean website, you talked about TMAO. And can you? I found this very interesting. Can you describe a little what this is and how it affects the animals that you're looking at?
Yeah, that's the first protective molecule that we found. It's called trimethylamine oxide, or TMAO. And anybody who lives along the coast knows what it is, because it's what gives marine fish and shrimp their fishy smell. So we've known about it for 100 years. It's the fishy smell. And it's at modest to low levels in shallow water fish and shrimp, and we weren't really sure what it was there for. What we discovered about 10 years ago is that that molecule increases with concentration with depth. The deeper you go, the more there is. So a deep sea fish, for example, or shrimp, is really smelly. But we wondered, why would it go up with depth? And we've tested a number of ideas about that, and the one thing that seems to work is that it helps against pressure. So that's one of those protective molecules I talked about. We can put it in a pressure chamber in the lab, and it will make the complex biomolecules like proteins and DNA work properly when you pressurize them. So it's a pretty special molecule, and it's also one that's being tested to treat human diseases as well.
Hmm. So I'm sure your lab space, when you bring these species up on the landers, is quite potent in smell.
If the tissues have been damaged, you can smell it.
And Dr. Yancey, you also do a lot of education and outreach and share a lot about the science that you're conducting. Tell us a little bit more about your website, marinebio.org, and the deep sea work that you promote.
Well, marinebio.org is a bigger organization. I'm just part of that. But the focus of trying to get information and news out to the general public on all kinds of marine issues: conservation, fisheries, deep sea exploration, and so on. So I'm in charge of the deep sea part. And what I try to do with these websites is, and I have another one of my own, I try to get news out about new discoveries, and I have an email link, so I get questions from students and reporters all the time asking me about things discovered in the deep sea, and I respond to them. So it's basically a way to try to get information out there.
And I think people are so fascinated with the deep sea. I mean, there's certainly a mystery that surrounds it. What are the most frequent questions you get, or what are people most curious about?
Well, one of them is the gigantism you mentioned. I get a lot of questions about that. Why do things get huge in the deep sea? And as I said, we don't know why, and not every group gets huge. So hoping somebody will solve that problem. Another one is how many new species are there to be discovered. We have no idea, but every time we go out, as I mentioned, we always find a few more. So I think there's a lot more to learn about the deep sea. There's very little that's been explored. If you actually add up all the different submersibles and net tows and landers, it's really only a few percent of the deep sea that's actually been explored.
And for you, what are you hoping to come home with after this expedition? What are your greatest goals?
Well, the immediate goal, of course, is to understand the pressure adaptations. We have some indication that this TMAO I talked about can only be built up so far in fishes, and we think that at about maybe 8,000 meters, 26,000 feet, they can't make any more, and that coincides with the deepest known depth for fishes. But amphipods go deeper. They go all the way to 36,000 feet, and we want to know how they do that. They have this sugar I mentioned that's being used for Alzheimer's treatment. They have TMAO as well, but we need more tissue to analyze them to discover what else they have. So we're hoping to find out how some animals, but not others, can go all the way down to 36,000 feet.
And
so I'd say that's the immediate goal that we want.
And as we picture you guys out on the Falkor ship in the next coming days, what are you going to be doing? So what is your plan for tomorrow? What's a typical day?
Typical day is we sit down with Patty, who's got all the geology for us, and has to explain it to us biologists. But we look for places where it would be a good place to put the landers down. We don't want to drop them on a cliff, for example. And we'll plan it out. And we'll go out in the morning and drop them down, and then the next day we bring them back up. Or sometimes we drop them at night. So we can be working around the clock. But that's the basic idea, is to plot out where to put them, drop them, bring them back up, and then have a team of biologists to process all the animal tissues very quickly.
I bet it takes a lot of hardworking effort to get those samples processed. Now, if our listeners are interested in learning more about the expedition or more about the deep sea environment from your website, where can they go for more information?
Well, they can go to marinebio.org, for example. They can go to the schmidtocean.org website, which will have a blog on the current expedition. And there's also the Hadal ecosystem website. It's called Hades. It's at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. Hades, or Hadal ecosystem study, is the parent project for the work that we're doing. So that also has a website on this research.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Dr. Yancey. I wish you and Dr. Drazen and Dr. Fryer the best of luck, and I'm really looking forward to continuing to follow your journey and see what you guys find in the deep ocean.
Yes, thank you. We're excited as well.
Excellent. I look forward to many more deep sea adventures. I would like to thank all my guests today for taking some time to talk about this deep, mysterious environment, the Mariana Trench. I want to give a special thank you to Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy, the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, and Kosi Island Earth. I'd also like to acknowledge some of the crew and amazing staff on Schmidt Ocean Institute's research vessel Falkor. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.